Fixing hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an FU commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part two.
I'm Brian Burke, president of hockey operations for the Pittsburgh Penguins, a team of pugnacity and tenacity. I missed out on Sidney Crosby and the draft lottery, but I got him now, you sons of bitches.
It's crazy. Nobody has brought that up, Sidney Crosby thing. That's crazy. I'm Ryan Lambert from Elite Prospects.
Sean McAnew from The Athletic.
Well, in fairness, Burke brought it up. Like, he's the one who brought it up.
Like, no. The second they were like, oh, Brian Burke's the head. Hey, wait a second. Sidney Crosby, he almost drafted him. Isn't that crazy? And then he was like, you know, I did do that almost, but then I didn't. And every time I see him, I remind him. No, we know. We're familiar.
Anyone talk to Bobby Ryan about any of this? I mean, I figured that would be the next step in the evolution of the story, right?
You're not talking to Bobby Ryan about him.
Oh, gotcha. So Brian Burke is the new president of the first, I guess, president of hockey operations for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Ron Hextall is our new general manager. Hextall was the one that we kind of saw coming. I mean, it became pretty obvious, I think, as the interview process went on, that he was the front runner. I do find it funny, like the whole "a flyer takes over the Penguins" thing has become such a thing when, like, the Flyers fired him. Like, he doesn't really like the Flyers anymore. Yeah, he doesn't give a shit. Like, did they make a bit?
You used to work for Yahoo Sports. Can you even do that?
Well, sure. Yeah, there is no Yahoo Sports now. What you call it? So, yeah, I mean, like, it was like when Lamoriello took over the Islanders. It's like, Lula, a devil? No, it's fucking, he wants to beat the shit out of the Devils. He fucking hates the Devils now. So the Hextall thing was not a big surprise. I guess maybe the surprise is that they hired a guy whose leading attribute is building the farm system and drafting well and being patient to a fault with his teams, which is the reason he got fired in Philadelphia. But I guess to counterbalance that, they hire rootin' tootin' shootin' cowboy Brian Burke, who never saw a big trade he couldn't make. And maybe that's the alchemy of this relationship, is you have patient building guy, and then you have, like, Pronger trade, Kessel trade guy. But the Burke thing was a huge surprise. I guess, Ryan, we'll start with you. What was your reaction when you saw the Burke part of this equation?
Why the fuck is Brian Burke getting this job? It doesn't make any sense.
Like I said, a surprise. It was a surprise.
It really... Like, I get it. He's been around for a million years. And, you know, for all the things negative you can say about him, the one thing that people have always rightly identified as, like, his whole deal is that he goes, well, you need fucking star players, you know, like, you, he always goes out and gets star players. And in this situation, he already has at least one. It depends on how you feel about how Malkin and Letang have played this year. I would say not very well. But the thing that makes it really insane is that interview he did a few weeks ago with frickin' Barstool, where he was like, yeah, I think their window is closed. I think they're cooked. This group is done. And now he's coming in and he's like, we're going to make the playoffs this year.
Okay. Yeah, this is...
All right.
You hear the sound? Hear that sound? That's the sound of me patting myself on the back for being the only person yesterday to ask him about that quote. Everybody else just like, is it Sidney Crosby? No, fucking ask the guy who said they can't win why he took a job to help them try to win. That's the thing you should be. That'd be the first fucking question of Brian.
Well, let's just say their offer moved him to a bigger house, remember, from The Simpsons.
Yes. Sean, describe this loss for the Canadian media to not have Brian Burke on track to be the new Don Cherry.
You know, Brian Burke was good on Hockey Night in Canada. I enjoyed him. He wasn't there yet as far as being like a finished media product, but he was pretty good. That said, I don't think this is a huge loss on balance for the media, because now we get to cover a team that has Brian Burke in a prominent role. Like this, I have no idea if this is going to work for the Penguins. I have no idea if this is going to turn out to be the right move. But just as a fan, this is great because hockey's more fun when Brian Burke is involved in running a hockey team. He's just one of the great characters in the game. He's one of the just entertaining guys, and I think this is going to be a lot of fun to watch from a distance. If I'm a Penguins fan, maybe not. Maybe it will be. I don't know. But as a if you're neutral and you're just looking for entertainment, I mean, Brian Burke getting parachuted into a top hockey ops role is pretty much perfect.
Well, on the will this work front, let's break it down. So you got a 34-year-old Malkin. I think Sid's like 33.
Yeah, it's and Sid Letang is 33. Yep.
Okay, so you got a core that is clearly on the other side of the mountain. You have an ownership, and by that I mean Mary Lemieux, who steadfastly believes that two of those guys are going to retire as Penguins, and Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. I heard a really interesting thing about Malkin and trades too this week and calling around, which is that
he's going to the Kings finally. It's happening.
Yes, straight up for Dustin Brown. No, there's at least this sense that Mario. Part of the reason Mario was gun shy about ever dealing Malkin was the Jágr trade, and what a disaster that was for the Penguins, which I don't know if that's true or false, but I find that it's one of those I want it to be true things that like he's so triggered by Chris Beach that he's never going to trade Malkin for anything. So they don't have a first this year. That's Minnesota's for Jason Zucker. They don't have a third or a fourth or a sixth. They have the 31st ranked pipeline for prospects in the National Hockey League, courtesy of Chris Peters. They don't have a lot to deal with. And they're also up against the ceiling, which means that and they're going to be up against the ceiling next year too, which means that many of the deals that they would have to make are money in, money out, and like well over half the league is capped out.
Yeah.
So it's I'm with you, man. Like I don't think this is like the worst spot to be in if you're Brian Burke and Ron Hextall as far as like a landing place, because the Penguins are a great organization. And obviously, like there's a lot of people that really like the Penguins more than I think the three of us do, as far as the way they're built this season. But I mean, for materially changing the roster, this is a big ass uphill climb.
Yeah, and I mean that is the real problem, right? Like anybody who makes a substantial enough amount of money that you would be able to move them for like a money in, money out deal where somebody's actually like good, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is either not a guy you want to trade like your Crosbys, your Letangs, even your like Jake Gensels, right? Or Brian Rust, or a guy nobody wants to trade for, like Mike Matheson. You know what I mean? Like there's either money that's being spent fairly well or money that's being spent poorly. And everybody else is on like a $1.2 million deal. And the other thing is, like, I think it's all but five or six guys on the team are signed this year and next year.
Yeah.
And so, like, 2 years from now, you'll have, you know, the full ability to turn over the roster. But the guys that are pending UFAs for that include Evgeny Malkin and Chris Letang.
Right, which is
and,
the problem.
But the problem is, even if you keep them, well, now they're like 34, 35, 36 years old.
Right.
So what would be the point?
Which is why the biggest challenge for Burke and Hextall is to convince Mario to trade Malkin, I think. I mean, from where I'm sitting. Am I right, Sean?
I mean, that would be the big move. Whether ownership would let you do it, whether the fan base would let you do it, I don't know. I thought it was interesting that Hextall didn't completely slam the door on it when it came up yesterday. He basically said, look, I'm not making any promises, when it would have been very easy to just say, no, that's completely off the table. You know, go ahead and lie. You just make it so that that's not part of the story.
Right.
It's what makes this so interesting, right? Because virtually any time a team hires a new GM, it's one of three situations. It's a team that's on the way up, and you've got the runway ahead of you. It's a team where the window is open right now to do whatever that team is going to do, whether it's win the Stanley Cup or you're just trying to make the playoffs, but you feel like that we're at the plateau. Or it's a team on the way down and you're bringing in somebody to blow it up and rebuild it. And I can't, off the top of my head, remember too many situations where a new front office was brought in a situation where it's very clear that they're in win now mode right now, but if Hexel and Burke stick around for the 5 or 6 years that a GM normally gets, they're going to have to do the rebuild in that window somewhere.
Yes.
Like, they come in knowing they have to do it. It's just a question of when does it start and how do you pull it off? And like, that's kind of fascinating to me. I think, and I get the sense that Hextall certainly knows that. It's going to be real interesting to see how Burke, in whatever his role is, however hands-on he is on hockey decisions, it's going to be interesting to see how he deals with it. Because this is a guy that 10 years ago in Toronto didn't want to do a rebuild. And
right.
He literally said at one point, I'm impatient. I'm too old to do a rebuild. I want to see this team win now. It's 10 years later now.
Of course you did.
Are you willing to do a full-on rebuild with a team like the Penguins? Yeah, I mean, I would assume he is, because I would assume that was part of the job qualifications, is that you have to understand that in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years, this is what's going to happen. But that's going to be really interesting, because usually when it's time to tear it all down, you might as well bring in a new group with fresh eyes and do it that way. And they're presumably not going to do that.
Yeah, the issue is that they're going, we're the Pittsburgh Penguins, we're here to win, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, but the guy you just hired as your president of hockey ops thinks that you either have to get real good real fast or real bad real fast, given the current makeup of the roster. And we just said, how do you get real good real fast given the way Jim Rutherford managed his cap the last few years? It's real tricky. And, like, yeah, Hextall has a really good record at the draft. And that includes picking everywhere from, like, in the top 5 or 6, I think, to, like, you know, late in the first round. And he got players everywhere. So that's not the issue. The issue is they have 2 picks this year, and the odds that they're going to be able to, you know, these aren't guys you trade for a pick and a prospect, the guys that they want to get rid of.
Right.
If you look at Hextall's trade history, it's all, you know, he did a really good job of getting fucking dead weight off the Flyers roster, but he didn't get anything back for it. Yeah. He just got the flexibility, and I don't know how you do that.
Well, I mean, one way you could do it is you let Brian Burke handle that side of it. Because, as I've said, but, you know, this is the case in Toronto, but it's the case everywhere else as well. Brian Burke doesn't draft well. He does not do free agency well. He has a bad habit of overrating his own roster and therefore not doing the things that he needs to do to make it better. And obviously, goaltending has been his Achilles heel for going back to at least the Vancouver days.
And now Brian Burke is
really, really, really good at trading. Brian Burke's trade record is phenomenal. It's right up there at the top of any GM out there. And he's not the GM here, but at the very least, that's the one thing I would, you know, when it's time to do the draft board, send him out for coffee, send him out to do something else. But when it's time to sit down and make a deal, for whatever reason, I don't know if it's a personality thing, if it's his connections, he's really good at getting deals done. That's what I would want Brian Burke involved in. But is Ron Hextall going to want to let him be hands-on in that, or is he going to say, this is a GM's job, get out of here?
Well, as I said, like, Hextall's trades are mostly, you know, leaving aside the Jori Lehterä deal, which didn't really work out. Except to say, I guess he got the Flyers' 2 first-round picks for Braden Schenn.
Yeah.
But you know, Lehterä was a bit of a bust, to say the least.
And got busted.
Yeah. So there you go. I'm just going to look at the list of guys he got off the Flyers roster. Scott Hartnell, Kimmo Tiiminen, Braden Coburn, Nicklas Grossman, and Chris Pronger. Vinny LeCavalier and Luke Shen, Mark Streit, like, those are all guys you don't want around, you know? And he was just like, oh, yeah, in the course of, like, 3 years, I got rid of probably $25 million worth of dead weight, maybe even more than that, just, like, guys who aren't good or literally weren't playing anymore. And they didn't take back a lot of bad stuff in return, so...
So, I mean, we're talking around it here, but it sounds like they hired two guys that know how to make a trade, and they hired one guy who has a proven track record of finding really good players deep in a draft, no matter where the draft position is for that team. I mean, it does sound like we're saying that they hired two pretty good guys to turn this shit around.
But
did they not?
They have to win now. That's the problem. Like, all the stuff we were talking about, making trades, drafting well, managing the cap, that's all good in a rebuild. I don't know how you apply those skills effectively given the current state of the Penguins roster. I don't know how you do it. And that's what I don't get about the hires, is it's like almost antithetical to, you know, it's certainly at odds with the stated goal, what these two guys bring to the table.
Right. Three predictions for this new leadership group in Pittsburgh. One, Brian Burke makes a trade for a player that's like a Chris Kreider-esque type, and immediately people say that the DNA of the Penguins are changing into a Brian Burke team. Two, they trade for a goalie, because as Ryan sort of mentioned, I think while Sean was talking, they have the worst save percentage as a team right now in the league with DeSmith and Jari, which is... I mean, the alternative would have been to keep Matt Murray, who's an abject disaster.
Say, Matt
too.
Murray's probably available if they want
to. I mean, I've said this very podcast. They should have traded for Fleury. Like, they should have brought him back. And so good for him in Vegas. And then the third prediction, obviously, is that things go poorly. They fire Mike Sullivan, and Ron Hextall hires a guy named Schmeckstall as the new head coach, yeah, as is his.
Does he
his
have launch. Any other kids who play college hockey? That's gonna be the big...
That's the real key.
Yeah.
That's the real key. I don't know. I mean, like Sean said, I mean, it's fun. It's a fun thing that's happened. It makes the Penguins infinitely more interesting than they would have been otherwise, where it just felt like if Jim Rutherford had remained there, they were sort of just dying on the vine. Now there's going to be, you know, there's going to be some fun ass Kessel adjacent trade that Brian Burke's going to make at least once. To try to turn this team around in the short term. And it's going to be exciting to see what happens. I mean, Ron Hextall will make that trade. By no means, I mean, Brian Burke is actually running hockey ops. Except he is. Do you think they're a playoff team this year, based on what you've seen? I guess it's the last thing.
Based on what I've seen? No. Could things improve? Yeah, but like their numbers aren't very good, like I think across the board. Basically it's very similar to Edmonton insofar as when Sidney Crosby's off the ice, they look like absolute shit, and when he's on the ice, they look like the best team in the league. Yeah, they're a shade over 50% expected goals at 5-on-5, but like they can't get a save, and I don't see that turning around anytime soon given who these two guys are.
What do you think,
yeah,
Sean?
I mean, I think the way it's shaping up, it comes down to them and the Islanders. I don't completely buy into Jersey yet. Buffalo, Rangers are in the mix too, so it's I don't want to say Boston, Philly, Washington are locks, obviously, but it kind of does look like it's going to be five teams fighting for the one spot, and could they beat out the Islanders? It's interesting. It's interesting that the first game of this new front office is against the Islanders on the 10-year anniversary of the that big gong show brawl game in which the Islanders attack the Penguins goalie. And so
yeah,
the Penguins 2 days before that go out and hire Ron Hextall. I'm just saying, if you're the Islanders and if the goalie looks a little weird early on in that Penguins game, maybe don't go near him or go out and get Billy Smith and see what he's up to, because it may be a trap.
The bottom line for me is kind of like what Ryan was getting at, which is one, the goaltending is dog shit right now, and yep, you're never going to be anything in that division if you're bottom five in save percentage. And two, I don't know. Again, I don't like judging a lot of these guys this season because it's such a fucked up season and there's no preseason and all this shit's going on. But Malkin's looked terrible. And if you're a one line team and you can't get him going to Malkin levels, and I mean defensively he's shit. He's been shit for years defensively, but offensively he's been completely invisible. And like, you can't have Evgeny Malkin out there looking like, you know, his controller has been unplugged. Speaking of unplugged, today's episode of Puck Soup is sponsored by Raycon. You know,
it's pretty good.
Raycon,
that's pretty good.
Thank you. Raycon is one of our favorite sponsors. We always like talking about products that we all use. And Raycon's wireless headphones and earbuds, those are things that I use on a daily basis. I talked about it before. I hate putting wireless earbuds in my ears and having them fall out when I'm running or working out. These guys don't fall out. They've got different fits for you, so you can find the one that you like. And the best thing about it is that once they're in your ears and they don't fall out, they also sound incredible. No dangling wires or stems to get in your way. They come in a variety of stylish colors. They're comfortable and they sound fantastic. They're water and sweat resistant, and they have a Bluetooth that pairs quickly and seamlessly with your wireless device. They've got a battery life of 6 hours. You know how awesome it is to go and use your headphones, and then you put them in the little thing. They're not even charging, but you can pick them up the next day, and they still work. Because it doesn't happen with all of these wireless earbuds, I'll tell you that right now. The best part, Raycon makes sound accessible to everyone with wireless earbuds, starting at half the price of other premium audio brands. Raycon's offering 15% off all their products for Puck Soup listeners. And here's what you got to do to get it. Go to buyraycon.com/puck. That's buyraycon.com/puck, P-U-C-K. That's it. You get 15% off your entire Raycon order. So feel free to grab a pair of the earbuds, get a spare, do the whole thing. That's 15% off at buyraycon.com/puck. That's buyraycon.com/puck. Cannot endorse this product enough. It is a life-changing kind of deal for somebody who likes to put in a pair of earbuds and walk around the house or go running and listen to their favorite podcast that have nothing to do with hockey. Okay, so much to my chagrin, there is a new top ratings getter for hockey soap operas. As the Puck Turns of Vegas has been surpassed by the Columbus Blue Jackets, who have been just an absolute fucking joy this season. I think COVID counts for like 50% of my content, and then like Columbus is like 20% at this point.
Yeah, easy.
All right, where should we start? Patrick Laine, Mikko Koivu, or the offside review? Which one do you want to hit first?
Let's build up. We can start with Koivu.
I was going to say the same thing.
Koivu is – this is an easy one, right? Like it's,
yeah.
It's this is a great underrated player who had a long career as a guy that partly because of the market he played in, partly because of his style of play, partly because of the lack of team success – didn't maybe get as much love as he should have, but it's sad to see it end this way. But also, you know, if I respect that if he feels like he doesn't have it, he wants to go out on his terms and not kind of sleepwalk through a whole season that he's not going to be proud of.
Getting yelled at by John Tortorella, too, fucking benched.
Yeah, that's when he made this announcement. I thought this was I'm simply just going to bench myself for the rest of my career. Yeah. Proclamation.
He's like, it's knives out for the Finns. I'm next. That's it.
Right. He's like, Jarmo, you were supposed to protect us. What happened, my countrymen? Do you think Mikko Koivu is one of those guys that and there's been a ton of guys in the last like 20 years that had to deal with this who just happened to be the best defensive center at a time when or I shouldn't say the best, but a really good defensive center at a time when there's just a guy running the fucking table on the Selke? Like, would he have had one right now if it wasn't for Bergeron?
He was only a finalist once.
You didn't score enough, right? Like that's ultimately what it boils down to. And
right.
Is that a fair way to assess fucking whether
of course
forward
not
is defensively competent? No, but that's how it's assessed. So,
oh, I always wanted to ask Sean this about the Selke. Do you think Peter Zezel should have won a Selke?
I mean, the Selke back in those days was all over the map. It was as weird as it is that we've sort of settled into this. It's got to be a two-way player, almost always a center who scores at least 60 points groove over the last decade or two. Like back then, anybody could win. Like there was like some guy won. He was like 22. It was his second year in the league. And they're like, yeah, you're the best defensive forward.
Right.
And it was not even a guy you'd even have heard of. Peter Zezel, I got to watch him in the Leafs. I loved Peter Zezel. He was that checking line for the Leafs was amazing with Osborne and Berg. He was fantastic on faceoffs. You know, you always heard about him being the soccer guy, and you know he would use his feet on the faceoffs. I wouldn't have objected to him winning, but I mean, it would have just been you would have needed the ping pong balls to bounce in whatever way they needed to that particular year. Based right. on how the Selke was handed out. But I love Peter Zezel. He was great to watch.
And he's not a Penguin or a Ranger, so obviously he's not getting any friendly bounces from ping pong balls. But
there it is.
I was trying to remember, as you were talking about Zezel, like when was the first time I remembered thinking of a center or hearing about a center that was like a dominant defensive center, like, you know, more known for their defense than their offense? And I think of two when I was a kid. One was Joel Otto. Just because, like, he was kind of portrayed at times as, you know, like the Gretzky antidote, you know, mm-hmm. from the Flames Edmonton rivalry. That was the first time I ever was cognizant of there being centers that were there just to play defense. And then as a Devils fan, the first time I ever thought about it was Lauri Boschman. Remember Lauri Boschman?
Yep.
Lauri Boschman was a guy who was strictly your defensive center. And I remember them acquiring him, and I'm like, who the fuck's this guy? And they're like, he's really good defensively. I'm like, all right, I guess we need that. And then, you know, as time went on, you had your John Baddons and other guys like that. Do you remember the first guy, Ryan, that you remember knowing a guy just because of his defense at center?
I feel like the answer, what's his name? The guy who was just like, oh, you put him out there and you're going to win the faceoff. What's it? Was it Yannick Perreault, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Was one of those guys, yeah.
Yeah.
Perreault was
pure faceoff. He was a guy who, like, you would put him out there in the final minute, and he was like the first Fogo guy, right? The first like face off, get off, I remember the Leafs again picking him up a bunch of times. I think he had three stints there, but they were like, "Well, you got to put him on the penalty kill," and they're like, "Yeah, but the problem is once he wins the face off, he has to get off the ice because if the other team gets the puck, you now have Yannick Perreault killing a penalty, and he's terrible."
Yeah.
But yeah, that was. There were some face-off guys. Guy Carboneau was the other one that, like, as he sort of took over
for Hall of Famer
as the Hall of Famer Guy Carboneau. And how's this for a segue? Because I was just looking at the Selke winners. The guy I was talking about, the 20-year-old who won, Steve Kasper, won with the Bruins. Probably best known to this day as being the coach who torpedoed his own career by benching Cam Neely, on Hockey Night in Canada in Toronto. Hey. Speaking of coaches that like to bench guys.
All right, let's go.
Conversation back on topic. Look at that.
I thought offside review was going to be the next one. Let's hit line A because your segue was too good.
Yeah, that's true.
What the fuck? Again, there's so much to unpack here. Let's start with the first layer of this parfait, which is that the Columbus Blue Jackets traded a guy that John Tortorella was benching for a guy that John Tortorella then benched four games into his Columbus career, which is fucking amazing.
And while he had like three goals in three games.
Yeah. And in a tie game against obviously a division rival that you're going to have to compete against for a playoff spot in Carolina, like you need offense. Their offense as a team had been going fucking batshit in the time that Laine had been there. Like the three games he had been there, they scored like 12 goals and he keeps them on the pine for like half the game. For reasons. I guess the Aaron Portsline reported today that it was something shitty that Laine said to a coach or something. I don't know. But it was also him kind of like sleepwalking through a defensive assignment or seemingly on a goal.
We all thought that's what it was. But apparently, at least according to the sources, it was based on him saying something inappropriate to an assistant coach.
That moment?
Presumably in the heat of the game.
Yeah,
The I bet the coach
said, "What the fuck were you doing on that play?" And he said, "Fuck off," or you know, something like that. You know, and like, I guess the big takeaway for me is, boy, if you didn't see this coming, you are a fucking sucker. There is no, there is no universe in which this wasn't going to be a thing that happened. Just like that's how Patrick Laine plays the game, and you put up with it because he scores, I don't know, 3 goals in 3 games for you. But not John Tortorella, baby.
Well, yeah, and here's so here's my thing on this, and I'll take the reports at their word that this was mostly about him saying something to a coach. And look, you got to have some form of structure and discipline. You don't want the coaches or getting screamed at by players. But that's the sort of thing that happens in sports a lot. It can be handled in a way that the public doesn't know about. Like that can be handled internally behind the scenes in the room, however you want to put it. And none of us will ever know about it. And the fact that they didn't do it that way, I can only think of 3 reasons. The first reason is that John Tortorella is just dumb and doesn't realize how this is going to look with a guy that just got brought in a trade for a disgruntled player and you're already singling him out. And I don't think that's an option because John Tortorella, whatever you think of him, is not a dumb guy. Option two is that this is – they've tried to handle it internally and this is an ongoing issue and they had to take it to the next level. But Patrick Laine's been there for like 2 weeks. Yeah. I mean, if it's that bad, it's really bad if it's already escalated to that. That doesn't seem to make sense. So the only other option I have, the only other thing I can think of is that John Tortorella just likes this. Like he likes to have this controversy. He likes to be the center of attention as much as he says, the last thing I want to do is bench someone. That he kind of likes this, feels it helps the team. I don't know if he thinks he's taken the spotlight off of guys or whatever it is. But it has to be intentional at this point that this is to do it to this player under these circumstances, unless there is some other piece of this story that we don't know about. All I can think of is that in John Tortorella's mind, this is actually a good thing that once again, everyone's talking about John Tortorella and player discipline and all the rest of it.
Now, the other thing to say about that is I'm trying to find it now. Stu Cowan yesterday tweeted Aaron Portsline, who covers the Blue Jackets for The Athletic, telling Tony Marinaro on TSN 690 a minute ago he thinks John Tortorella might want out of Columbus himself, which could be why he benched Patrick Laine last night for the entire third period. Now, that made me fucking laugh.
Yeah. It made me laugh, but I mean, listen, Portsline knows more about the Blue Jackets than I'll ever know in the span of my life, so I'm not going to say that there's not something to it. But first of all, like Tortorella owns like a ranch around Columbus. Like he's pretty set up there, like life-wise. And the other thing is, why the fuck would you ever want to leave that job if you're John Tortorella? Like you're in a market where there's no expectation. You're in a market where you could do this bullshit thing that he does all the time, which is just coach to the bubble. So he's been coaching to the bubble every year for the last decade. Yep. He's been a head coach. You know, him and Yarmo get along pretty well, apparently, unless there's some schism now with this Laine stuff. Like, it is a very, very – he could coach there for the next 6 years. Like, there's no expectation for the Blue Jackets to be anything but this team. And I'd be shocked if he wanted to get out of there. Unless he wants to go to Seattle. I mean, Seattle didn't have a coach yet, did they? Maybe he wants that challenge. Who's to say?
Seattle can't be that fucking... you can't have John Tortorella be the first coach of a team.
The face of your team, the first guy, is somebody
who's motherfucking 10-second
press
local media.
And,
it's like my job is to bring this team together as a team. So I benched the entire team in the second period. Yeah. Nobody's on the ice. We lost 25-0 because there was nobody on the ice. The benching thing's hilarious because as Tortorella's like, the last thing – I don't like benching guys. The last thing I want to do is bench somebody. You had fucking Cam Atkinson right before him saying, hey, we've all been benched. We've all been that guy before. Everybody gets benched at some point. Just like – it's like a rite of passage. It's just beautiful.
Like how little self-awareness do you think he has that he's like, I hate benching guys. It's the worst part of my job.
Well,
it's like that's the only shit he does.
outside of the lawyer who forgot his cat filter was on during that Zoom call, the biggest joy I had on the internet this week was the memes that came out of the Tortorella I don't like benching guys thing. I think my favorite was, I don't like eating giant jugs of honey, said Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
Like, it's just great fucking shit. As the Torts Turns continues, again, I cannot get over the fact that they traded a guy that he was benching for a guy that he is now benching. This is impossible symmetry.
Again, how did you not see it coming?
Yeah.
Just given who the player is and who the coach is and what their reputations are.
How do you not have the voice in the back of your head going, you know what, let's not bench this guy over this? Because the other thing is, you know, there's a part of it that says, hey, the new guy has to play by the same rules. You can't have him come in and, you know, be treated different. Players notice when somebody is half-assing it out there or not, you know, covering their assignments or whatever it is that happens on the ice. And maybe you worry that if that's happening and you don't take action that you lose the rest of the team. Players don't care that you swore at a coach. Unless he said something really awful. Like, there's no player who's going to be like, I can't believe coach didn't step in and do something about that. So,
it's Patrick Laine. Like, what did he say? You're a noob? I mean, like, what the fuck is Patrick Laine going to say?
You use so offensive. I do not use aimbot. That was
I mean, maybe he had a heated gamer moment, you know?
Exactly. That's all.
Don't want to get with those.
A throw the controller level of anger in that moment.
Oh, no, I'm talking about when...
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about a cancellation level moment. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Heated gaming moment, folks.
The delete the Twitch stream moment.
That's right.
So, I don't know. Like, I got asked on the radio the other day this question, and I said the answer is Line 8, but I'll ask you. Who's there in longer, or who's there in like 5 years, Laine or Tortorella?
Well, here's the interesting thing. The answer seems like it's going to be neither of them, right? Because they're both out of contract at the end of this year. And if I'm Patrick Laine and I'm getting benched 3 games into my fucking career on this new team, I'm like, get me the fuck out of Columbus immediately. And then obviously with Tortorella, it's like if they don't make the playoffs this year or even come particularly close. Do you want to re-up that whole deal and, you know that you're maybe going to lose one or two other guys, blah, blah, blah? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, when in doubt, always pick the player over the
coach.
Sure,
yes.
That's, especially when it's a young player who's you've just gone out and made a big trade for. But, who knows? You're right. There's no guarantee he has to stick around much longer if he were to decide that this isn't where he wanted to be, although we always expect that to happen in the NHL, and it almost never does.
All right, and then finally, and come to think of it, benchings happen so frequently in Columbus. This might be the most interesting story that's happened to the Blue Jackets this week. The if you missed it on Sunday, Carolina scores a goal that on review looked clearly like Vincent Trocheck was offside. And so the Blue Jackets challenge it. And then according to, again, Aaron Portsline, because he talked to Colin Campbell, took a bullet for the team, as it were, talked to Colin Campbell. According to that conversation, the linesmen come over, they're reviewing the play, the war room is reviewing the play with the NHL, and then somebody, I guess it was somebody inside the arena, said that's a good goal.
Yeah.
Apparently, they've got a new person being there's the process involves the officials on the ice and the war room in Toronto. And then there is like an in between that's in the arena whose job is just to coordinate and make sure everyone can hear each other and see the same things. And apparently they're training a new person. And that person at some point chips in their opinion and says, oh, that's a good goal. At which point the officials hear that and go, okay, got it. Take off the headsets and skate away, which that on its own is – I mean, I understand that people are really mad and Blue Jackets fans are furious. But this, for the rest of us, this is hilarious. Like, it's a Benny Hill
objectively
sketch.
Funny.
Because apparently what happens is the officials – go, okay, thanks, guys, put the headsets down and leave. The war room realizes what just happened and starts desperately screaming for the officials to come back. And normally what would happen is after the officials are done on their headsets, they give it back to an official who's in the penalty box and he puts the headsets on. And so the league is expecting that guy to hear them saying, no, no, bring him back, bring him back. But because of COVID, that guy has to clean the headset before he can put it back on. So he's sanitizing. Like, I'm sorry, man. I just pictured this guy sanitizing a headset, unaware that Colin Campbell is screaming and to bring the officials back. And they go and they drop the puck and play goes on. And then so, where it gets really weird is,
yeah,
as per, you know, the league does the review and realizes they screwed up. It's too late. It's ruled a good goal. Columbus gets a penalty because they challenged and they didn't win the challenge. So that's 2 minutes against them. And then the puck drops. And once the puck drops, that's it. Like that's it. That's in any sport. Once the next play starts, that's it. You can't go back. You can't have a redo. It was a screw up. Everyone admits it's a screw up. But you can't go back and say, you know what, we changed our mind. It's no goal or whatever. Except that the league then does exactly that for the penalty. Right. During intermission, because this all happened with like a minute left in a period. During intermission, the league calls down and says, we screwed up. We can't go back and make it no goal, but we're going to take the penalty off the board, which there is nothing in the rule book that allows anybody to do that. There is no, I'm the obscure rule book guy. There is nothing in there that says in the event of whatever, you can just go and take a penalty off the board. But they did that, which of course has Columbus fans say, well, if you could do that, why not just take the goal off the board?
Right.
Since there's no precedent for that either.
Well, the reason they did that was, well, there's no precedent for it. Right. But,
right,
but there was no precedent for the other thing. Well, there was no precedent for the thing of the
that
other
was
thing.
The most so incredible thing about that was Colin Campbell saying, logic. We can't take the goal off the board because there's no precedent for it, even though they took the penalty off the board to make a precedent to do that.
Yeah.
And the entire time, I'm just screaming, what the fuck do you think precedent is? Do you think there's a judge who's like, I don't know if
Colin
I can
Campbell's
rule
like,
on this?
Joe Biden is precedent.
Anyways, but you're right. Yeah. So the officials came to the two teams' locker rooms during intermission and said, hey, just want to let you know.
Conversation.
Yeah. It wasn't us or the war room. It was Skippy the intern who said that that was a good goal. And then we just took it at face and we fucked up. God damn. It's such a perfect story.
And by the way, like,
And then they lose by a goal.
That precedent is there for a reason. Like, it shouldn't be possible to go back. And I know there's, again, this is, once again, a weird once-in-a-decade thing happens in the NHL, and immediately everyone's like, we got to change the rules because we have to just get it right and blah, blah, blah. Like, no. Like, once the play started, you shouldn't be able to go back and change things. What they should have done is they should have called the referees and said, the first Carolina Hurricane who breathes on anyone gets a two-minute minor. Like, if you haven't called a penalty on the Hurricanes within 5 seconds, you're all fired because we're going to even it up that way. That's the way that stuff is supposed to be evened up.
Yeah, that's hockey.
Yeah, that's hockey, baby. You got
that's the Chicago way.
The game and make sure both teams have the exact same number of power play opportunities. But the whole thing is so dumb and so ridiculous and so funny as long as you didn't have a rooting interest in the game itself. I just really hope that NHL doesn't do the NHL thing here and be like, we need all new rules for this thing
symposium
that has never happened before.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I liked was that because Columbus got screwed by like the clock ticking weird.
Mm-hmm. In L.A.
In L.A. And there was another thing that happened that was, you know, and someone was like, is the league conspiring against – like, the league is so unfair to the Columbus Blue Jackets. Yeah, the team nobody fucking thinks about. Them and the Minnesota Wild are the two biggest targets of the league's attempts to, like, fix the results of a given game. Come on. Like, the simplest explanation, I guess, is that everybody who is in charge of the league is incompetent. And they prove that – I don't know, five or six times a season.
I love that this happened, and somebody in the league was like, you know who needs to be our public face of this explanation? Who's got a lot of credit? I know, Colin Campbell.
It's fantastic.
If Gregory was still playing for the Blue Jackets, it's a whole different story.
Yep.
Oh, and to answer your question, because I was curious because I didn't know the answer, the next penalty in the game was on Patrick Laine. So,
got to bench him for that shit. Can't let him get away with that.
So that is as the Blue Jackets turn. What a fantastic soap opera. What's next? I didn't even check this morning. Did they accidentally shoot Max Domi out of the cannon? Like what happened today?
Oh, that's the other thing. There was I think Portsline wrote it, was like, this Max Domi at center thing isn't working out. It's like, no shit. Wasn't that the joke for 3 fucking years in Montreal? Shit, it didn't work out. Come on,
I guess that's another thing that happened in this year is they traded for Max Domi. He's not working at center, and Josh Anderson's going to win the fucking Rocket Richard. So things are going great. Things are fantastic. I guess our next segment
fucking
should be
rocks, man.
Doesn't
I
it
love
though?
It.
Isn't it great? Who doesn't love it, kids? Our next segment is called COVID Onovid, in which we discuss all the problems the league is having existing this year. As of right now, the New Jersey Devils, Minnesota Wild, Colorado Avalanche, and Buffalo Sabres all have their games canceled in perpetuity, I guess, or postponed.
Yeah.
And then the Flyers had to postpone their game against Washington this week. By the way, I'm working on an SI cover-esque curse now where I wrote about Jack Hughes last week. Devils got canceled out. Wrote about JVR this week. Flyers got canceled out. So taking nominations for who you want me to apply the hex on next. How are we feeling about things, boys? We gonna get this rickety bus over the finish line or no?
No, absolutely not. This is a disaster, and it seems to only be getting worse. You know, like there was a real problem in the NBA for a little while, and a few teams had a few games canceled, but they like figured it out on the fly, kind of. And the most recent thing I saw from the NBA, which I bring up only because they're the other fucking league playing right now. Is that they had no positive tests in whatever the last week they released the info for. So that's great news.
It's wild.
Do I think the NHL can do the same thing? For a lot of reasons, no, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, get across the finish line as in finish a season. I still think they will because they seem very motivated to do that. And when I say they, I mean the league and the players.
I was talking about in terms of everybody gets to 56 games.
Everyone
gets
to 56,
happen.
I do not think is going to happen at this point. That's why I think, you know, I had somebody tweet or email me or something saying, like, should they just switch the standings to points percentage now?
Of course.
Like, start getting people's head around the fact that, you know, this is how it's going to it's going to happen because – yeah, I don't think we're getting 56. And, you know, the big thing right now is a key pillar of the league's plans all along has been that they didn't believe that there was significant risk of in-game transmission. They were concerned about the teams themselves, and you know, that's why you had people sitting 6 feet apart in dressing rooms and you couldn't go to Alex Ovechkin's hotel room to watch a movie and all of this stuff. But they felt or chose to believe that in-game transmission wouldn't be a big issue, but now it looks like it is because we've got situations where not only are teams who happen to have played each other both seeing outbreaks, but we've even got officials from the same games. I mean, at this point, we don't have to, you know, we don't have to be dumb and pretend that we don't know what's happening there. So.
Well,
that's
not,
where it gets.
Hold on, it's not buried. Dumb. I mean, like they're all sharing the same facility, and they're all walking through the same hallways. Like, I don't think it's dumb to question whether it's an on-ice transmission or if it's just.
Well, no, but if both teams and the officials from the same game can infect each other, then whether it's happening on the ice or in the facilities is completely meaningless. It's a distinction.
Sure. No, I agree.
That is in-game transmission, even if it's not happening on the ice. That means that.
Well, I think the difference though, Sean, is that like you can still do XYZ inside the building to try to make sure that you separate all parties better, but you can't do that on the ice. So I am curious what the official what they think happened, especially with Buffalo and Jersey, because you're right. Like once you start talking about the officials getting infected, now you're talking about a whole different level of concern. And actually, the whole different level of concern I'm getting from talking to some people is, you know, they did all this shit before the season to try to make it as safe as possible. The thing they didn't know about before the season were these new variants that are apparently a lot more. You can get affected a lot easier, you know, and they're you know, people are it's just jumping from person to person in a way that the OG COVID didn't, which is why, you know, there's like now scuttlebutt about should we do more genetic testing? You know, should we understand what this stuff is? Because COVID tests check to see if you have COVID. They don't check to see what variant you have of it. So it may be just simply like they didn't budget for this. In talking about what they thought they could do for the season. They planned for one thing, and now it's something else.
And this is why I've been saying all along, the NHL should get rid of the pregame tradition where everybody kisses each other. It's just – it's ridiculous.
But it's my favorite part of the pregame. I like watching
NBC. It's one of hockey's grandest traditions, Greg. Yeah, I understand.
But I love seeing guys smooch while Babcock's telling me about, you know, something that happened on the 2009 Red Wings. Like, it's the best part of the broadcast. I agree with Sean. Like they're gonna finish this season in some way, shape, or form. I do.
Yes, of course they are.
I do wonder if it's too much money, but I do wonder if like at some point they start talking about bubbling up at all, or you know, is the plan still, since things are, look, all this shit in the NHL is happening at a time when COVID rates around the country are dropping. Like things are getting better. Now we'll see what happens after the Super Bowl, but things are getting better. And the plan was always like, we're not going to need a bubble by the time we get to the postseason, because we're going to get fans back in buildings and start making money again. And I wonder where we are on that now. I'm genuinely curious about what those conversations are behind the scenes.
The vaccine rollout's been such a fucking disaster in most of the big states, which is to say most of the states where, you know, NHL teams are, I guess.
California in the house over here. Just want to mention what a fucking disaster it's been here.
Massachusetts, bottom six in the country in percentage of the population vaccinated. You know, famously a state with a lot of hospitals, and they always talk about, oh, you know, we're one of the global leaders in healthcare and all that shit. Yeah, it's going really bad. But they did announce today that if you bring somebody 75 plus to get vaccinated, it doesn't – they will also vaccinate you. So, like, I just figure the Bruins are going to have, like, Pasternak and Marchand driving around with a big net looking for elderly people.
Do you need a QR code for that, or, like, a coupon or anything for that? Or does it just happen? Because that sounds like a pretty good deal.
Yeah, no, it just got announced today. I have no idea what the – but I have a big net and a car, so.
Yeah, here it's just a disaster. Like, I mean, it's amazing to me how California was like the standard bearer for a long time of like how to handle this shit, and you know, the lockdowns, and we were way ahead of the curve. And then ever since that point, it's just been fuck up after fuck up after fuck up, to the point where like you got Gavin Newsom standing before the state being like, we've got to be more vigilant and lock down the restaurants and shit, while at the same time he's eating dinner at fucking French Laundry with a bunch of people indoors.
Well, I don't even – you know, honestly, that's not even – the issue to me. The issue is, like, Gavin, individuals can make individual choices even if they're the fucking leaders of the state. You know, rules don't apply to the elites, and we all should understand that. But what the
no reason to bring the young bucks into this. Sorry, go ahead.
What the problem is that, like, the state is going, well, you gotta go to fucking work. And then people are like, well, if I gotta go to fucking work, I'm gonna go to the bar after.
You know, and I'm gonna go to a restaurant and unwind, because if I'm seeing people at work all the time, then I might as well. I'm just gonna fucking get it anyway, you know. And so, like, the idea of Massachusetts, like last week, was like, you know what? Let's get restaurants back up to 40% capacity, and the numbers are doing better. And it's like, but you're just tell everybody to stay home.
That's the single most. It's the single most Bostonian thing you've ever said in this podcast. It's like, you're going to work. You obviously have to go to the bar afterwards.
Well, no, I'm saying that's just what people feel like. It's true, though.
I completely agree.
I work from home. I don't give a shit. I don't go anywhere. It's
a return to the sense of normalcy is what you're saying, and I completely understand what you're saying. All right, back on the hockey thing. I think they're going to get through the season. I am – the other thing I'm curious about with the NHL, and I'm trying to get somebody to talk about this, but like – what was their internal projection or their internal, like, threshold for what the season would look like right now? Like, what I'm trying to say is, so we've got four teams that are off the grid for, like, a week. We've got another team in the Flyers that might be there. You have an entire division that hasn't been impacted by this at all. And you have a number of teams that, if they have been impacted, have simply been impacted because they had to have travel quarantines or what have you, and haven't had like outbreaks of COVID within their dressing rooms. So I genuinely am curious whether they're looking at this and side-eyeing it and being like, oh shit, fuck, we're heading into NWHL territory here. Or are they looking at it and being like, actually, this is going better than we thought it would. I don't know the answer. Like, do you guys have any thoughts on how they feel about it?
I don't know how you can feel good about half the teams in the league have played 8 games and the other half have played 15.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think they were hoping to have, I mean, 5 teams and counting. Well, it's been more than that.
Yeah. Well, we got to include Dallas in there. Yeah.
And by the way, we should point this out. As we're recording this, we don't know exactly what happened last night with Vegas and Anaheim.
Right,
There could be, by the time you hear this, you may already know that, you know, that those teams are on the sidelines too. I can't imagine that's what they were hoping for, but it would be nice to know. It would be nice if there was some sort of communication about that and some kind of leveling with your fans about what the expectations are, but that's not how this league ever works, so I don't see why it would.
There's no precedent for them telling us.
No precedent. So why would they? Something's got no precedent.
We need Skippy the intern to be like, actually, COVID's real bad. So I agree. Like, I can't imagine the disparity in games played is something that they're pretty happy about right now. But, you know, the other thing I wanted to mention is that I went through the list, and there are 5 teams that have not had a single person on the COVID lists this season. And the only American team from that group is the St. Louis Blues, which probably not coincidentally is the team that got hit by COVID and, you know, around the bubble last year.
Right.
So it kind of makes you wonder about the herd immunity aspect of this thing, in particular about some of the team, like the Devils and the Stars, for example.
Well, remember last year, everybody was like, what if a bunch of guys on a team get COVID and then they're really good in the playoffs? Maybe it makes them insanely talented.
Right.
Oh, okay.
It's super soldier serum.
And look, the other thing with this is, like, it's getting to the point where there's so many names going on and off the list. And yes, we all know by this point, just because you're on the list does not mean you have a positive test, et cetera, et cetera. It can be any number of things. But there's so many names being associated with this. So far, we haven't had a situation where anybody got seriously sick that we know of. We had there's the Marco Rossi thing, which where he was – that was before the season that he tested positive, but we're only finding out now. But beyond that, like, we haven't had a situation really publicized where a player or a coach or whoever, like, was not okay after a couple of weeks. And once that happens and starts – because it will – we've seen it in the NBA, we saw it in the NFL, that's going to change the discussion too. That's going to get some, because right now it feels like even the pessimists are kind of operating under this assumption that if you test positive, you quarantine, and then in 10 days you're fine because you're a young professional athlete. don't know that for sure, and that's going to be maybe the next, you know, that shouldn't change any public opinion because it won't be new information when it happens, but it will feel that way.
Yeah, and there's so much we don't know about this shit, and it's scary, and I don't like it.
Let alone 10 years from now.
What it's going to be like.
We have no way of knowing.
Alexis Lafreniere has 1 goal in 11 games. Discuss.
I mean, you know, not everybody should be in the NHL at 18, even if they're really fucking good.
It's true.
He also didn't have an option to play many other places this season, so...
That's it, right? And it's, you know, for him to go back to junior wouldn't have been... Even in regular times wouldn't really have been an option because he's too good for junior. Too young to play in the AHL.
And that's the real problem, right? Like, the transfer agreement between the NHL and the CHL does not allow for guys to be 18-year-olds in the AHL.
And which it should. But I don't know. I mean, look, we're seeing in Jersey, like, Jack Hughes did nothing last year. He looks good this year. Sometimes it takes a year or two. There's a long list of, you know, we all remember the guys like Connor McDavid and Austin Matthews who come in and look like stars right away. But there's lots of guys who... Like, Joe Thornton had 7 points in his first season.
Vinny LeCavalier is another one.
The Sedins took, like, 3 years to be more than 30-point guys. So it does take time. Like, nobody should be saying he's a bust or anything. But if I'm the Rangers hoping to make... if I'm the Rangers, I'm trying to make the playoffs this year. This is obviously not what you wanted from a guy that you were kind of, fingers crossed, might come in and really give you a boost.
Kaapo Kakko, 3 points in 10 games. Lafreniere, 1 point in 11 games.
Yeah. I'm more probably worried about Kaapo Kakko at this point.
But he looked good to start the year and just dropped off immediately. I really wonder, you know, if it's just a case where there's just not really a good supporting cast for all these guys to, you know, put them in a position to succeed where...
You mean like centers? Especially when Zibanejad's not been all that great this year. Like, they're really hurting at center, the Rangers this season. But fuck, man. Like, you know, even as we talk about these two young players and their struggles, I would give anything to have the Rangers roster right now. Like, if I was a fan in the NHL. Fucking, you're going to have Adam Fox and Keandre Miller on your back end for the next 10 years.
Yeah, Jack Johnson.
All right. You take the good, you take the bad. You take them both, and there you have Jack Johnson.
Right. So the issue is, are the Rangers a playoff team this year? So it's starting to look like the answer is no. It looked at the beginning of the year like a soft maybe. You know what I mean? And
when they signed Panarin, I figured it was going to be like by year three of Panarin that they were going to be a contender. So I think they're still on track.
I think that's about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But the decisions they've made personnel wise, like last summer, even you were just like, okay. I mean, I thought you guys wanted to be in the playoffs, but
and the thing that worries me a little bit if I'm a Rangers fan is that there's not really anyone on this roster anymore who's like an old guy that you're going to flip for future assets. You're at that stage where, barring another lottery win, you're not going to be picking top five. You're not going to expect to finish, you know, bottom five of the league and get a real high pick. So, yes, there's still opportunity to bring in more talent and reinforcements that way. But you're kind of looking at the roster going, this is maybe what we've got as the core going forward. Their players are going to get better as they get older, but this is pretty much most of it is here. Is it good enough? Do we actually see this being something that's going to be the core of a championship caliber team? Or it is, you know, sometimes you get to a rebuild, you get to the other side of it, and you look and you go, we still got a few missing pieces, and now how do we go out and get those?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously what you do is you trade Tony D'Angelo for Sam Bennett, right? That's what they were going to do this week.
Yeah. That's it. As somebody tweeted at me, the Tony Bennett trade. We need to make this happen.
That's the Tops. The Blackhawks are good again. Ryan, this must be very difficult for you.
It's not. They're not good. They
they have a goalie who, if I'm looking at this right, is like 930 plus here, and his career average, like his highest average save percentage, and it was in the Finnish league, is 919. And that's a good number, you know? But does that make Kevin Lankinen a fucking Dominic Hasek type? I was going to say,
he's a 933, and his career average in the NHL is, 933, because he's played nine games.
Yeah. He's the Calder leader at this point, the best goalie. We were all on Shishkin's tip. It turned out to be Kevin Lankinen.
We all looked at the Blackhawks, and we were like, it's the goaltending is what's going to carry them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, they're not good. They're better than anything than anybody thought they would be. Just like even in terms of they don't look horrible every single night, you know. And now they're just getting insane goaltending that is in a short season maybe only need 10 games of insane goaltending.
If they make the playoffs, what does that say for Jonathan Toews' legacy as a leader? Yeah.
Overrated. He's out.
Makes you think, doesn't
trade
it?
Trade his ass. You don't need him.
By the way, I hope he's okay. We haven't heard anything about Toews in a while.
Yeah,
so.
we haven't, and that's concerning.
That is concerning. League is a better place with our stoic leader in it. Lankinen is leaps and bounds better than any other rookie goalie right now. It's pretty incredible. He's you had your Shishkin. He's at 916. And then you had, Sorokin with the Islanders. He's at 871 for save percentage.
He was going to be the guy on the island, mm-hmm. You know.
And then your boy Jake Oettinger is doing pretty good. He's got a 919 behind the Dallas Stars with Bishop being out. Yeah. So, good times for rookie goalies. I still think it's going to be a forward, a defenseman, and a goalie in your final three for the Calder this year.
That feels like it's. Just how it's going to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But good stuff for the goalie so far. All right. Moving on. A couple more topics to hit. Sean, what was your reaction to all of the TSN shit this week? I mean, obviously, we have our own reaction to our sweet friends, the Curtain Bloggers, getting spiked at the TSN station in Vancouver. As Vancouver, Winnipeg, and Hamilton's TSN stations are now flipping to an all comedy format? They're just going to play stand-up?
I think one of them is, and one of them's going to like a Bloomberg News.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're shifting to formats where they won't have to pay anyone to.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, broadcast. It's brutal. It's brutal that because this goes back to last week, right? We've seen a lot of cuts. At TSN and media properties across the board, you know, Brent Wallace, Dan O'Toole, if you go on down the list, and it's, you know, and behind the scenes too, obviously the people that who are on camera or on the air are the ones that you may know by name, but there's a lot of people behind that. It's awful. It's awful that this is coming obviously in a brutal media environment, but also from a company in Bell that is a huge multi-billion-dollar conglomerate and is still counting relative pennies to put really good people out of work, and doing it all 2 weeks after their big Let's Talk mm-hmm. PR campaign about the importance of mental health. And then not only do they go and do this, but the way it's been handled has just been completely unforgivable, the way that they've treated people, and it's awful. And
do you mean playing a pre-recorded message during somebody's show and then following it with a song called Good Riddance?
Like people finding out on Twitter that the radio station they work for doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's such a mess, and it's terrible. There's no other spin to put on it. It's awful as a person, but even if you want to put that aside, just as a sports fan, like we've lost a ton of good voices that we needed. And I don't know where it stops. We've seen Sportsnet go through it. Now it's TSN's turn. Who knows where it goes next? It's really an ugly situation all the way around, and I don't think it's all that much different down where you guys are.
Yeah, we've known Mike and Jason for a really long time. I mean, like, I remember, you know, we used to have them on Puck Daddy all the time because they mm-hmm. were our favorite Canucks people. They were, like, doing an incredible blog before they went to NBC, and then they got this radio gig. And it's the worst part about this is when you know something is successful and then it gets shoved to the side because of corporate budget bullshit. And there's no doubt that their shit was successful. There's no doubt that they rated well. There's no doubt they put on an amazing product, that they had a following, that the show meant something to people. And then just to have it destroyed by big nameless corporation who went so far as to record the "thank you for listening to the Vancouver radio station" announcement in Toronto by some rando. It fucking sucks. Those guys are great. And I know they're going to be okay because they're incredibly talented. But fuck, man, I loved doing that show every week. I used to do it every Wednesday morning. I would talk to them for like 25 minutes on the radio just about stuff. And I know that show meant a lot to people. And those guys are two of my favorite people in the business. Not to say everybody else. I mean, there's a lot of really good people that lost their gigs. But fuck, man, Mike and Jason losing their gig really, really struck me as just being one of those – like, what the fuck are they doing kind of moments.
Yeah, especially because they took hundreds of millions of dollars, if I'm not mistaken, in certainly a lot of money in government, like, wage yep. relief. And it's weird. They cut all their, like, shareholders bigger dividends of late. That's crazy that happened.
Look, every year the Bell Let's Talk thing happens. I find it inspiring because it does allow people to open up about their own personal struggles. It does, at the end of the day, raise money for a cause that's in need. Tax I get all off. That. But I don't choose to participate in it. And I've gotten shamed for it in the past. But this is exactly why, because like yeah. you, at no, the I'm, end of the day, it's an advertisement, and it's a yep. tax.
I'll say right now, I'm done with it. Not with the conversation. We can still do that.
I'm done with
people
the conversation.
Can still share their stories,
this
but I'm
has
done.
Soured me.
I'm done with the hashtag. Is what I'm done with. Like I'm done with providing corporate cover for a company that clearly does not give a crap about this stuff when it comes to their actual decisions. And it you know, I can picture in my head, I'm sure it happened, there was a meeting somewhere where they had to decide how many days after the hashtag could they do this to people.
Yeah, it's
where
ghoulish.
It would be long enough that it would be okay. And yeah. I guess they settled on 2 weeks or 10 days or whatever it was.
Yeah, and right. and the other thing to say is, like, this Bell is not alone in this, right? Like, the supermarket that throws out food that's, like, 1 second past its expiration date instead of giving it to, you know, food banks or whatever, they're also now going, hey, you want to chip in it? Like, your total came to $43.20. You want to chip in an extra 80 cents and we'll donate that on your behalf? Like, right. It's all fucking – it's all bullshit. Yep. And it's all you know, a way to, A, you know, burnish their image, right? But also to get a tax write-off. Because that's and their money that they then donate. They,
and like Sean said,
they're adding a middleman to it.
Like Sean said, like the hardest thing about this whole thing when it comes to that hashtag is just like you have this hashtag about mental health and depression and all this other stuff. And then, you know, a week later, it's like, Bell, let's talk about you packing up your desk in the next 30 minutes. Like yep. fucking – I mean,
literal people who, as part of that hashtag, shared personal stories
right.
of struggles they've gone through, a week later get to find out from that company through Twitter that their job doesn't exist anymore because they can't even bother to pick up the phone and have a face-to-face conversation with somebody.
It's brutal industry. Speaking of that, I know this was actually something
sounded
in the mailbag.
Like an ad transition.
No.
Speaking of brutal industries.
Brutal industry. LinkedIn.
Salt mine.
Rich Cook wrote, Sean, as a Canadian, what are your thoughts on the layoff of Dan O'Toole and the breakup of SportsCenter with Jay and Dan? I guess I could also ask you about the breakup of Tim and Sid, too. Like, those mm-hmm. are two iconic duos of the last, like, 15 years in Canadian media, and both have been broken up in the last, like, month.
Yeah, and you know, Sid and Tim by choice, as far as we know, with Sid going and taking a different job. And yeah, Jay and Dan were part of, for the last decade, certainly, they were a great Canadian media story, because that's, again, like, it resonates with me a little bit, because these are two guys who didn't fit the criteria and the view of what you were supposed to do in that sort of job, but they came along and found a different voice, and it caught on with people, and it turned into something. And the fact that that's not going to be part of it anymore, their producer as well, and others who worked on the show, to just have it all broken up like that, it's ugly, and it's going to be, you know, again, if you want to be completely heartless and just put all of your actual human empathy aside and just purely be selfish on this and say, what does this mean for me as a fan? It sucks. Like, that's two great combos who did great work that aren't going to be part of the landscape going forward. And, you know, what's going to move in and replace them? Maybe it'll be someone else who's great, but maybe it'll just be more cookie cutter, cut and paste stuff grabbed from some other source. And, you know, here we keep on going down the spiral of what sports media looks like these days.
I would have rather seen Tim take the morning show gig. Like, the weird IT guy on the morning show strikes me as being more interesting than sit on the morning show, for being honest. I love those guys. I worked with them at The Score. Remember The Score?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. I worked there.
I mean, they still do. They still make content. They have actually a couple of good writers there. But, you know, back in the day, that was like the birthplace of Elliot Friedman. They did wrestling.
Oh, yeah. Exciting. Yeah, a lot of people got their start there. And
Yeah. Did Skeets get a start there? Or did those boys just do their show there?
That sounds right, actually.
I actually remember where they started. I think at one point, like, they did, The Score had like a blog and network that they had started up that I was a part of in the very, very beginning of things. So,
wow. In the beginning times. Yep. Ryan didn't watch the Super Bowl, as you know. He's not a football guy. Sean, did you watch the Super Bowl?
I did. Bad game. I mean,
terrible game.
Unfortunate. Even
horrible game.
You know, even if whether you're rooting for Brady or Mahomes or whatever, if we didn't get the game that we were hoping to get, unfortunately. So that's,
I don't know if you can count this as part of Brady's legacy, but how many times have we seen situations where people just lose their fucking minds when they play a Brady team? And don't, like the Rams did, and like the Chiefs did, and they just play horribly in that spot. I guess you could say it's part of Brady's legacy that he's such a cool as a cucumber in the pressure situations, that he keeps his team from doing dumb shit. But I feel like he's been the beneficiary of teams absolutely imploding in the Super Bowl during
his
career.
I think the one that everybody brings up is the Seahawks Super Bowl, where they were just like, oh yeah, we're gonna throw it on fourth and one or whatever. I don't remember the down situation, but and then it got picked off and run all the way back, and that was the end of the game. And it's just like, you had the win and you fucking overthought it.
And on the Chiefs one, like, they didn't have an answer for the front four for the Bucks, and then, you know, they made so many fucking mistakes defensively during the game as far as penalties go. I mean, like, being offside on a field goal attempt and shit like that. It's just unconscionably bad decisions. So yeah, the game sucked. It was such a disappointment. The commercials or whatever. It was. I do like the idea, the notion that, because of COVID, more famous people made commercials this year than ever before, like Matthew McConaughey and Will Ferrell and people like that were making commercials because they didn't have anything else to do. I think there's probably something to that theory. Commercials were whatever, and they weren't all that good either. So it was just a big, big bummer, the Super Bowl, on top of not being able to like get with people and watch it together.
Unless you were at the Super Bowl, in which case you had all the opportunity you wanted.
Or you're the Tampa Bay Lightning in a socially distant, masks up, hotel ballroom.
Yeah, totally believable that was the case.
We should also mention, because, you know, this show is such a big fan, there is a new M. Night Shyamalan movie where it's a spooky beach where people age.
And it's called Old. It's just called Old. That's fucking incredible.
Remember when he made a movie about a mermaid living in a motel pool?
Yeah, and it's not even his stupidest concept.
Now that would be when the trees attacked people through the wind. That would that be the stupidest movie?
You know, Greg, I think it would be.
I don't know.
Although the part where the guy walks into the lion cage or whatever and the lions just rip him apart, that rocked.
There was some cool, like, real just gruesome shit in that movie that gives me – allows me to give it at least a little – like, the people just kind of, like, falling off of buildings and stuff was really – it was, like, gruesome. I for me, as a big fan of Unbreakable, I'm, like, a huge Unbreakable fan.
Yeah, can you shoot so funny?
No, that's not what I'm talking about. And I liked Split. The one that – the third one, what was it? Glass, was it?
Glass.
Did you see it?
Yeah, kind of a dud.
Terrible movie. Bruce Willis got killed in a puddle.
I saw the movie. I know.
Yeah, it's fucking terrible.
Yeah, and then the big promised boss fight that everybody was so excited about, the whole movie didn't happen because he got fucking drowned in a big puddle.
And, well, it happened for 2 seconds, and like somebody got thrown against a van, and it dented the door, and that was the end of the.
Well,
fight.
Remember? No, I thought it was a thing. See, now I saw it once. I don't fucking remember. But wasn't it a thing where they were like, "Uh oh, something bad is brewing down at this skyscraper," and then it was just like you could see the skyscraper in the background.
Yeah, they didn't get to the skyscraper. No, that's right. Yeah, it's like Mario and Bowser fault before we get into the castle.
Right,
it's completely true. Sean, do you avoid Shyamalan movies because they're spooky?
No, I've seen a few of them, but not, I mean, I kind of went Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, what was it? Signs.
Yeah.
And then I saw I guess The Village, and that was the first one where I was like, oh, this isn't good. Like Signs, I kind of retroactively go back and I'm like, yeah, that. A lot of that didn't work, but when I watched it, I was like, yeah, this is a good movie.
It's a really gripping movie while you're watching it, but just don't think about it. And also, the performances in that movie are great. Mel Gibson is so underrated as an actor. I think he's great. And obviously, you know, Joaquin became what he became, but at the time, nobody was like, oh, Joaquin Phoenix, one of the greatest actors of our generation. But that scene where he's in the closet watching the video of the Brazilian birthday party or whatever.
The Vamanos, Children Vamanos scene. It's fucking tremendous.
That scene is incredible.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think I've told this story before, but like when The Village came out, my girlfriend at the time and her parents and I all went to see it. And we all walked out of the theater going, you know, it was whatever. And on the way home, everybody was just getting progressively madder about various parts of the movie. Yeah.
Two things. First of all, I'm an unabashed Signs fan. I don't know why Signs became aligned. I know people make fun of like the water, like, oh, why the aliens come to a planet filled with water if they
I mean that's not like a minor plot hole. That kind of ruins the whole premise of the movie.
But they didn't know about the water. That's like if we went.
How do you not know about the water? It's the big fucking thing. It's the blue thing, Greg.
They started they're like, hey, why is everyone dying? We can't quite put our finger on it.
They've been watching us for years.
They know what the
fuck
water is.
The fucking movie. And then they get down there and they're like, the raincoats. Fuck.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's like going on vacation near the equator. You're like, I could probably handle the heat if the beach is nice. They thought they'd be all right with the water.
They have invisible spaceships. This shouldn't be fucking hard for them. Anyway, now that I'm screaming about plot holes in a fucking 20-year-old movie.
And a Shyamalan movie, no less. Yeah. The Village – the fuck up of The Village was instead – they should have done a smash cut reveal that it was Modern Times. Instead, they did sort of like – remember they did like the slow burn of like there's a time capsule that they're opening?
Well, again, that was a twist I figured out 8 minutes into the movie. Right. You know, and, like there's no
– And I did too. And I never figure stuff out in movies. Like I consider myself a relatively smart person, but I am a utter drooling moron when it comes to movies. I get confused super easily, and you can misdirect me with anything in a movie. So when I am like 10 minutes into the movie being like, I bet I know what's going to happen, that's not good.
That's not good. It's a bad sign. All right. In honor of Tom Brady winning another Super Bowl – I figured we'd do an overrated, underrated, favorite, least favorite on a topic that has been covered incessantly in the last week, including in an upcoming column for me, Goats. Greatest of all time in sports. And I wanted to get your sense of the most overrated, underrated, favorite, and least favorite consensus goats for each sport. Like, who is the most overrated? Like, for example, for me, obviously, Brady's the most overrated goat. I mean,
I think that's a good point, yeah.
Football is a tremendous team sport. And Brady,
and
I mean,
you're
not
hearing
to slight,
it more and more.
Not to slight Brady. Brady's great. He's a fantastic player and, you know, what have you.
Probably the best quarterback of all time.
Yeah. I mean.
The thing with Brady is it's the whole, like, now he's the greatest athlete of all time. And it's, somebody said on Twitter, like, two countries in the entire world play this sport with any level of seriousness. You can't be the greatest athlete in the history of the world when 90% of the planet has never even tried.
Yeah, I do want to be like the guy who's like, you know, like LeBron couldn't be the best because Jordan was the best. It was so much, but for like the ancient Olympics, like Lyptherios of Sparta is the greatest athlete of all time.
Well, like, have you ever seen those lists of like highest paid athletes ever? And there is like a guy like that is number one because like back then he was given a gold bar, which was actually worth more than
the
entire kid. So it's like they always put him and then Michael Jordan. And you're like, we could probably do two lists. It might be okay.
You know what? If he predates the birth of Christ, I think we can.
Underrated. I'm going to go Gretzky. I am stunned by how Gretzky, because he's a hockey player, has been left out of a lot of these conversations this week
about
Brady.
On this podcast, we talk all the time about how he's probably not the greatest hockey player of all time.
But I don't know how he can be underrated in that. But in the GOAT conversation, he's clearly our nominee. Like, we all know Mario's better. I mean, Mario's a better player than Gretzky. We all know this.
Sure.
But, oh, Jesus Christ. So, actually, it's funny. I read a Boston Herald column about Tom Brady, and it brought up Bobby Orr and not Gretzky, which is, again, stunning to me. But again, I just feel like our sweet hockey boy, and this is all please like my sport, I understand this, doesn't get top of the – you get like Ali, you get Brady, you get Jordan, and then Gretzky's never like right in that mix in a lot of these analyses of GOATs, and it bums me out. So I'm going to say Gretzky's underrated.
I said it on Twitter kind of half joking, but then I really thought about it and it's true. Secretariat, is an all time great athlete. Like if you look at the picture of when Secretariat won the Belmont Stakes, like the next horse is a dot in the, on the horizon. And like, you know, obviously is a horse an athlete is the big question, but like, I don't know. People watch that shit every fucking year. So,
I'm a huge horse racing fan, and I never had a problem with them putting Secretariat on the best athletes of the century list that SI did. Because then when it happened, people were like, well, why don't you put Dale Earnhardt's car on the list? I'm like, because a fucking car is inanimate. A horse is an athlete because it's a living thing. So it's okay to say that the horse is an athlete.
Yeah. But for underrated human athletes, I think Bill Russell is a guy who doesn't get enough credit for completely changing the sport of basketball. You know, you look at it's not just the fact that he won like 17 titles or whatever the number is. It's between the NBA and college that is, but it's. It's more the fact that they played basketball one way before Bill Russell played it, and then Bill Russell played it, and they were like, we can't play basketball the old way anymore. He's too good at that.
Which CFL player are you going to choose? Rocket Ismail, Donovan McNabb, which one?
Doug Flutie. Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, it's clearly. Pinball Clemens is my pick. No, I just as far as underrated. I mean, this guy's not underrated. But Babe Ruth, the fact that he was dominant in two different facets of a game, where that never happens. I mean, it would be like the equivalent of like Connor McDavid just playing goal for the Oilers at like a Vezina level every few games and then switching back out front and playing forward and dominating that. It's you see it, like, there's some comparisons where, like, you know, in football they used to play both sides of the ball, yeah, but everybody did because that's what the sport was. Like, even a century ago in baseball, there was nobody else who was pitching and hitting at right. that level, and
it was so such an anomaly.
It's kind of, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, if you go back in time and kidnap Babe Ruth and drop him into today's league, he's not going to be the best player, but it's the relative to what anyone else has ever done.
Another, just another guy who changed the way the sport got played. When
I mean, he changed the way the sport got played offensively, as far as being the first, like, real home run slugger. But he didn't even change the game as far as other players being like, I'll pitch and hit, because nobody could do it. It was like, oh well, okay, I guess we're all
just right. No, it's it's that probably apocryphal story about Ty Cobb where, you know, the media is like, you know, Babe Ruth's hitting a lot of home runs. And he's like, hitting home runs is for losers. Anybody can hit a home run. And they were like, yeah, come on. And he was like, no, I'll do it right now. And then he, like, in a double header, he had, like, four doubles and two home runs or something like that. And then the next day he had, like, you know, two bunt singles and a yeah. double. But, like, yeah, after Babe Ruth, everybody was like, oh, I guess it is easier if you just hit the ball so far they can't fucking get it.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Also, he was built like a latter-day Orson Welles, so I think there's something admirable about that, too.
Yeah, that's cool.
Favorite Serena Williams, without question. And I know the GOAT conversation gets a little weird when it comes to individual athletes, like, you know, Michael Phelps or Serena or Muhammad Ali. Well, yeah, and so, yeah, Roger Federer. So, like, I find that sort of juxtaposition between those athletes and Brady to be interesting, but I don't think it's disqualifying, and I think Serena has been so incredibly good for a couple decades now that she's been my favorite. Also, I've gotten to see her play a few times at the U.S. Open, and it really is sort of just, like, a rock star experience to watch someone as dominant.
Did you see that video, like, from last week where she's giving basically like an MTV Cribs of her house, and she's
so
in her,
yeah,
and she's in
so
her
great.
Trophy room, and she's like, I think this is a second, no, this is a first place Wimbledon trophy.
Yeah.
This is the old one. It used to be a lot smaller. Now it's bigger. I have like three of each. Ooh, this is a second place one. I have to put this in the garbage. Like that was so fucking good.
Yeah. This is an ashtray. It's my,
and like, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, Venus was having her moment and she was dominant, and it was like your thought was, oh, this is gonna be the GOAT, like, and then Serena just blew past her and kind of redefined the sport for like two decades. So she's fucking phenomenal. I love Serena Williams. She's my favorite GOAT.
My favorite GOAT is the home run king, Barry Bonds.
Now, excuse me, sir.
I don't care. I don't care about any of it. He hit the ball fucking 500 feet, 700,000 times. He fucking, again, it's the thing of there were multiple seasons where he would come up to bat with the bases loaded and they would go, let's just put him on because, well, it's better to take the one run against instead of the four he is undoubtedly going to serve up into the fucking bleachers. So, like, I just think it's, you know, he completely changed his game. He used to be like a 40-40 guy, and then he was like, yeah, I'm just going to get insanely good at, like, knowing where the ball is going to go before it leaves the pitcher's hand and walking constantly.
I've always felt like I'm sure we covered this when we talked about the Hall of Fame, but, like, I always felt like him and Clemens had Hall of Fame careers well before
you assume
they started using performance-enhancing drugs. So I never really understood why Bonds is – I mean, I guess it's just because if you cheat, you cheat or whatever.
Well, it's because he was an asshole to the media.
Yeah, and so was Clemens, and I'm fascinated to see what happens in a year when all of these soapbox holier-than-thou writers get to vote on David Ortiz, who everybody loves – but who also shows up on, you know, failed test lists and in the Mitchell report and all of that. And suddenly I have a feeling a lot of people aren't going to feel as strongly about this when it's a lovable Boston athlete who is who is in the running. That's going to be interesting.
Love it.
My favorite is Muhammad Ali for obvious reasons, not just not just everything that he meant outside of the sport, although he was really one of, if not the first athletes to transcend sports and try to be more than that. It's just also the nature of boxing. Like when he was the heavyweight champion of the world, boxing was a huge sport.
The sport,
it was
yeah.
ever. This isn't Tom Brady in two countries. This is like every country in the world had people trying to beat Muhammad Ali and they couldn't do it. Whereas now it's fallen off so much that boxing's one of the few sports where I think you actually could go back to somebody from the 60s and 70s and say they might actually be the best ever. Like they maybe could beat guys from today as opposed to most other sports where you're like, yeah, they would just get destroyed. And you know, also just watch the guy. He's so fascinating to watch in the ring, out of the ring, everything. Just my favorite athlete ever.
That's the one thing that I feel like Brady doesn't have is that sort of like iconic, generation defining gravitas.
No, like the Tom most Brady famous... is Tom Brady is a got a hockey player personality.
Yeah,
he's or and maybe that's part of the appeal. But I mean, he's
a hockey player personality, and the most famous thing about him is like his diet beyond the winning.
And he's got a supermodel wife, and he thinks that if you drink 900 gallons of water a day, you won't get sick because he didn't. So clearly, that's how it works for everybody.
Least favorite for me. You know what? To kind of piggyback off of Ryan's choice for favorite, I think for me it had to be Lance Armstrong because he ruined the sport. Yeah. he's the worst goat. Absolutely ruined the sport.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are certainly people who still are big cycling enthusiasts or whatever, but... Yeah, that's a tough sell.
I mean, he redefined the sport much like Muhammad Ali did, but in the worst possible way. In the way I don't give a shit about the sport anymore.
But before that, he made you care about the sport, where you're like,
correct.
Holy fuck, this guy's so good at. But my answer, not really similar lines, Tiger Woods. I never, whatever. It's hitting a fucking ball in a hole.
Tiger's tougher. I agree on Tiger. Like I was thinking about Tiger for this answer, and that's a tough one for me because I do love the fucking sort of insurrectionist thing that happened when he became a star and took over the sport, and all of a sudden a bunch of guys who looked like Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus were watching this young buck come through their sport and just dominate and fucking set records left and right. Like there's something beautiful about that. But I agree, like as a person. Nah.
I don't even care about that. I just don't care about golf as a sporting endeavor. I'm just like, whatever. Well, Jack Nicklaus? I don't know. Probably. But it doesn't matter. Here's the thing. Did he invent a delicious drink that everybody enjoys to this day? No. So fuck off. Get out of here.
And by that, you mean the Chichi Rodriguez, correct?
I'm assuming he's a professional golfer, but...
He is. I played golf for the first time, as you know, recently. So I am now a golfer. So I can say that
you've played the sport.
Yeah, I've played the game. So I completely understand everything about Tiger Woods in a completely different way now.
I haven't watched that documentary though. Maybe I watched that documentary and it all changes for me.
I got to get through that Britney documentary before I hit the Tiger documentary. So
that's going to be a tough watch.
Oh, I've seen the first episode or whatever, and it's a tough watch, but it's also an incredible watch. Hey, anything that maligns the reputation of that squeaky clean Justin Timberlake is okay by me. Who's your least favorite goat, Sean?
This is maybe a slight reach in that you don't see this guy mentioned as often anymore, but there certainly was a time when he was. Carl Lewis.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Kind of related to what you guys are saying. This guy was obviously a legendary track star in an era where everybody was cheating and everybody was on drugs. And he talked a lot of trash about how he was going to win gold. And he went out there and he got his ass kicked by a Canadian named Ben Johnson, who was on drugs. And Carl Lewis cried about it, about how unfair it was that he got beat by a guy who was on drugs. And then, guess what? Turns out Carl Lewis was on drugs too. just like everybody else in that race was, and everybody in that sport was. And yeah, Carl Lewis, right. Carl Lewis cheating in a sport, which is fine because everybody else was cheating too, and got his ass kicked in the biggest race of his life.
The only pushback I would give now is that, of course, nobody considers Carl Lewis the greatest of all time because Usain Bolt exists.
Yeah. Well, the thing with Carl Lewis is he also did the long jump, so it was kind of like the track star. Yes, you're right. I mean, anybody from that era would just get
washed.
Usain Bolt could run backwards and beat all of them.
Yeah, I remember there was some article on Deadspin a million years ago that was like, we're reaching like the human physiological limit of how fast we can run. That was so fucking good. I don't know if you can seek it out anymore. I don't know, like if it got wiped off Deadspin servers or whatever. But like, it was one of the most fascinating articles I ever read where they were like, yeah, look at these marathon times. Like a marathon 20 years ago a world record 20 years ago in a marathon wouldn't put you in like the top 50 of any major marathon anymore. That's how fucking much it's progressed, and it will continue to progress along a similar trajectory for a little while longer, but then there will just be a point where the human body physically can't run 26.2 miles anymore faster than that.
That was I remember reading that, and it was like, and this wasn't like, oh, without steroids. This was like, this is physically how fast a human body can go. And I think at the time they thought 9.6 was the limit. And then Usain Bolt runs a 9.58. So, I mean, it shows you how ridiculous he is. But yeah, I just remember as a Canadian, it was infuriating listening to Americans cry about Carl Lewis and how he was clean and clear. And you're sitting there going, look at the guy. Like, no, clearly he's not. And then we found out that he wasn't, and everyone stopped talking about steroids, and you guys all went to cheer up for Lance Armstrong and talk about how clean he was.
Oh, man. Canada will have its revenge. All right. Well, that was a robust conversation, a very good one, and a good show. We had a lot to work with this week, which is always good. Our thanks to the Penguins and the Blue Jackets for that. All right, that's the show for this week. You can read me at ESPN. Many of my things are on ESPN Plus. My news stories are not. And wrote about JVR this week, which was a fun piece. And got some other stuff cooking here and there. So do check that out.
Yeah, sign up for epringside.com. We have a whole big group of new writers over there, including me, of course. We're doing all kinds of covering the NHL stuff. It's not just prospects anymore. From what I understand, there is a whole bunch of new people signing up, so that's great. Let's keep it going. And while you're at it, hey, why don't you sign up for the Puck Soup Patreon as well?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Good deals. You can find me at The Athletic. My writing is there. I have a piece this week where I put together a Team Canada Olympic B team, and try to figure out how many countries they would beat. And you can also listen to me there on my new-ish podcast on The Athletic Hockey Show Thursdays with Ian Mendez. Check that out. Go drop a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts, and let me know what you think. I would welcome the feedback.
Well, there you go. So that's exciting. Thanks, everybody, for listening to the show. Do check out the Patreon. As the Patreon subscribers know, I dropped a video there last week that I made on my home computer.
About Rafe has pivoted to video.
Yes, about Bill Simmons claiming that Terminator 2 invented the summer blockbuster, which is demonstrably false.
That's a take, all right.
It is a take, defined as a take. And then, of course, check out the mailbag. And also a bonus episode coming your way this week, which is a really fun one that I think you'll enjoy. And all that and more, obviously, on the Patreon at all times. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.